Good morning, everyone. This time we'll start reading this side, go this way. This side's been neglected recently for the reading, I think.
People have to sit there, is that what you say?
You can sit there and then you'll get a chance to read.
I read last week, so I'm going to sit there.
According to the little note I've got here, last week we stopped at page 589 on line 269. But I've received a suggestion that maybe we didn't thoroughly read that last passage, and perhaps we should start again this week on page 588 at line 217. I think the line is, as ceased the ruthless and tremendous voice. Death has been offering to Savitri gifts to soothe her wounded life. And he says, I can give gifts to soothe thy wounded life. These, if thy will accepts, make freely thine. Choose a life's hopes for thy deceiving prize. Would you like to continue from there, Turiya?
As sees the ruthless and tremendous voice, unendingly there grows in Savitri, like moonlit ridges on a shuddering flood, a stir of thoughts out of some silence born across the sea of her dumb, fathomless heart. At last she spoke. Her voice was heard by night. I bow not to thee, O Duke of Death, fly of night, to the cowed soul of man, unreal, inescapable and unfinished. Thou grim jest, played with the immortal spirit, conscious of immortality, I woke. A victor spirit, conscious of my force, not as a suppliant to thy gates I came. Unslain, I have survived the clutch of night. My first calm grief moves not my seated mind. My unwept tears have turned to pearls of strength. I have transformed my eel-shaped brittle clay into the hardness of the statue's soul.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about this? Lines?
Yes. Ridges is an edge?
Ridges. What he's talking about is the way that waves look. A ridge, of course, is the edge of a mountain or something like that. Or we can have ridges marked on the ground. But in this case, it's moonlit ridges on a shuddering flood. It's the sea, it's moving like that, and there you can see the edge of the waves turning over. And there's something moving in Savitri at this offer of God, of the God of death, no? When that shuddering, yes. So, but that's again the movement of the sea, of the waves here. And then all this stir of thoughts. He's offering her something. He says, I choose a life's hopes for thy deceiving prize. It won't be worth anything, whatever you choose. But anyway, choose. And something very deep stirs in Savitri's heart at this offer that he's making to her. What will she choose? So at last she speaks very defiantly. I don't bow to you, Death. You're just a falsehood, a black lie of night to the cowed soul of man. Human beings are too ready to fear you. You present yourself as the inescapable end of things, death, as if death must come to everything. But you are unreal. You're just like a bad joke that's being played on the immortal spirit, but you're not going to deceive me. I'm walking here conscious of immortality. I am a victor spirit and I'm conscious of my force. And I haven't come to you like a beggar, not as a suppliant, have I come to your gates. You've seen how I was not forced to die. Unslain, I have survived the clutch of your night. Yes, I felt a strong grief when you took away the soul of Satyavan. But that first strong grief is not moving my mind. My mind is still firm and steady. The tears which I haven't wept have turned to pearls of strength. I have transformed my ill-shaped, brittle clay, my physical body, into the hardness of a statued soul. It's not going to be broken so easily. Tera.
Now, in the resonance of the splendid gods, my spirit shall be obstinate and strong against the vast refusal of the world. I stood not with the subject mob of minds who run to glean with eager, satisfied hands and pick from its mire with many trampling feet its scornful, small concessions to the weak. Mine is the labor of the battling god, imposing on the slow, reluctant years the flaming will that reigns beyond the stars. They lay the law of mind on matters worked, and bring the soul's wish from earth in conscious force.
Thank you again. These are very defiant words. Are they clear? Anybody would like to ask anything about these lines?
These last four lines, describing the work of the gods.
Sorry?
From the last four lines.
Would you read the lines?
Imposing on the slow, reluctant year, the flaming will that reigns beyond the star. They lay the law of mind on matters world and make the soul's wish from earth's inconstant force.
Yes. So these lines, yes. So she says, I'm not like ordinary minds, the subject mob of minds. And the image he gives is of somebody scattering coins for poor people to run and pick up whatever they can. But she says, I'm not like that, who run to glean. It means to pick up the last little remnants there. Eager, satisfied hands, they pick things up, the scornful, small concessions to the weak, whatever life will give to them. She says, well, I am one of those battling gods who is imposing on time, on the slow, reluctant years which don't want things to change. Along with those gods, I'm imposing the flaming will that reigns beyond the stars, beyond the limits of the material universe. Those gods, what they are doing, they are imposing the law of mind on matter in order to win what the soul desires. To win the soul's wish from earth's inconscient force, from the material world. The divine beings can impose by the power of mind, by the power of will, they can impose a higher order on this material world. So she says this as an introduction to how she's going to answer him. He's made her an offer, yes?
Yes. She says, mine is the labor of the battling gods.
She makes herself the equal of the... Yes.
Line 235, she same God?
Yes, it's the same gods. Mm. And these gods have different aims, even, if we go right back to the very beginning of the poem. There's these gods battling. They have different aims. She's going to claim her aim. She's claiming back the soul of Satyavan. Yes. Yes. She's claiming to be the equal of those battling gods. Yes. Ushi, will you read what she asks?
First, I demand whatever Satyavan, my husband, waking in the forest jungle, out of his long, pure childhood's lonely dreams, desired and meant not for his beautiful life. Give, if thou must or if thou canst, refuse. This bowed his head in scornful cold ascent, the builder of this dream-like earth for men, who has mocked with vanity all gifts he gave. Uplifting disastrous voice he spoke, indulgement to the dreams my touch shall bring. I yield to his blind father's longing heart, kingdom and power and friends and greatness lost, and royals trapping for his peaceful age, pallid bombs of man's declining days, the silvered beacon glory of life's fall, the one who wiser grew by adverse fell, God's iris store, the deluded soul prefers, to impersonal nothingness bare sublime, the sin or the spirit of the moon.
The sensuous solace.
And the light I gave to eyes which could have found a larger realm, a deeper vision in their chasm less night. For that this man desired and asked in vain, while still he lived on earth and cherished hope. Back from the grandeur of my perilous realms, go, mortal, to thy small permitted sphere. Hasten swift-footed, lest to slay thy life, the great laws thou hast violated, move open at last of thee their marble eyes.
Thank you. So she tells him, give if you have to give me something. If you can, you don't give me anything, if you can refuse. And he bows his head, he agrees, he accepts. He does that as the builder of this dream-like earth for man. He's built this, that's his idea, that all this is his creation. And he has mocked with vanity all gifts he gave. And that's what he's going to do again now. He says, whatever gift I give you, it won't be worth much. But this is what he's offering. He says, indulgent to the dreams my touch shall break. So I'm going to give something. It will satisfy or it will respond to the wishes of Satyavan's blind father. I yield to his blind father's longing heart all the things he wanted and didn't have. Kingdom and power and friends and greatness lost and royal trappings for his peaceful age, that he won't have to live in the forest anymore, that he can really live like a king with the respect that's due to a king. And the pallid pomps, the pale glories of man's declining days. As we grow older, our glories grow less and less. The silvered, decadent glories of life's fall. Something that's decadent is falling away from its summit. So that's what happens to us in old age. Death says that Satyavan's father grew wiser because of this adverse fate he had to undergo, this stay in the forest. But now, he says, I'm giving back to him gifts, good things, that the deluded soul prefers. It's making a mistake, but anyway, it is preferring these goods that I'm giving to the bare sublimity of impersonal nothingness. That would be more valuable. But anyway, I'm giving back to him the sensuous solace of the light. He will be able to see. This will soothe and please the sense, the senses of sight. I'm giving back sight to these eyes, which could have found a larger realm, a deeper vision in their fathomless night. This is something that crops up in literature again and again, that perhaps it is wiser that the blindness can be a gift which gives a deeper experience, a deeper knowledge than our ordinary everyday sight. It's just a suggestion. It, again, he's trying to reduce the value of the gift that he's giving. These eyes could have found a larger realm, the realm of subtle sight, inner sight, a deeper vision in that deep, immeasurable night which they are suffering. But that's what this man, this is what Satyavan desired and asked in vain while still he lived on earth and cherished hope. That's what I'm giving. So now you have to turn back. Back from the grandeur of my perilous realms, my dangerous kingdoms. Go, mortal. Go back, Savitri, to thy small permitted sphere, this small round of life that you are allowed. Go quickly, quickly, hasten, swift-footed, lest the great laws that you have violated, moved, open at last on thee, their marble eyes, as if there are eternal laws watching there. They are allowing this short play, but you'd better hurry up and go back to your human realm, Savitri. Otherwise, they will open their eyes and see that you have violated their laws, and there will be some punishment to follow. But Savitri is not impressed.
What it means, pallid?
Pallid, it means pale, without bright colors.
And then 252, the builder of this dreamlike birth for man.
That he's claiming to be that builder. Karen, would you like to read?
But Savitri answered the disdainful shade, "Broad spirit, I was thy evil spirit born. My will too is a law, my strength a god. I am immortal in my mortality. I tremble not before the immobile gaze of the unchanging marble hierarchies that look with the stone eyes of law and fate. My soul can meet them with its living father. Out of thy shadow, give me back again into earth's flowering spaces, Satyavan, in sweet transiency of human limbs, to do with him my spirit's burning will. I will bear with him the ancient mother's load. I will follow with him the earth's path that leads to God. Else shall the eternal spaces open to me, while round us strange horizons, fiery sea, traveling together the immense unknown. For I, who have trod with him the tracks of time, can meet behind his steps whatever night or unimaginable stupendous dawn breaks on our spirits in the untrod beyond. Wherever thou leads his soul, I shall pursue.
Anything to ask? She claims to be his equal. I was thy equal spirit born. I am immortal in my mortality. So I'm not afraid of these gods you're threatening with me with, these marble eyes. I tremble not before the immobile gaze of the unchanging marble hierarchies that look with the stone eyes of law and fate. My soul can meet them with its living fire. She is not intimidated. And she demands, out of thy shadow, give me back again into earth's flowering spaces, Satyavan. Give him back to me alive in the sweet transiency of human limbs to do with him my spirit's burning will. I will bear with him the ancient mother's load. Hear the ancient mother, earth. It's a kind of load, being an earthling living on earth. I will follow with him earth's path that leads to God. And otherwise, the eternal spaces will open up to me while round us, the two of us, I will go on following Satyavan. Round us, strange horizons far recede, traveling together the immense unknown. For I, who have trod with him the tracts of time, with time and life on earth, I can meet behind his steps like a real traditional Indian spouse. She will follow in the footsteps of her husband. No. I, who have trod with him the tracts of time, can meet behind his steps. Whatever night or unimaginable stupendous dawn, perhaps our fate is not going to be night at all. It's going to be a glorious dawn, maybe. Whatever breaks on our spirits in the untrod beyond, where no mortal feet have trod. Wherever thou leadst his soul, I shall pursue. I will follow him wherever you take him.
This line 287, having bear with him the ancient mother's load, does she mean she bear his child?
Sorry?
Like ancient mother, she have a child with her? Do you mean that?
No, I don't think so. The ancient mother is the earth goddess. Yes. So, and the load of earth, there is a kind of load of difficulty which we material beings have to carry. It is different from what the spirits who are not, who don't have physical bodies. They have a different kind of load to bear, maybe. She's talking about the load of earth. I want to return with him to this material world and live with him here on earth. Is it okay?
Line 281, the unchanging marble hierarchies that look with the stone eyes of law and faith.
That's what he's been threatening with, these marble, unchangeable ranks of law, and he threatens her with these things, but she's not impressed.
Yeah. But I wonder, suddenly I thought about what you told in Doha at the beginning, about the stairs and the different beings.
Yes, there are these marble hierarchies, but here I think he's insisting on his role. I think death is insisting on his role as the god of law and of karma and consequence.
He's also saying stone eyes of these.
Yeah,
yes,
they are not kind, loving eyes. They are marble eyes. They can't really see. No? Or they see in a very brutal sort of way. That's how I understand it.
Nothing to do, Nothing to do with the ones which are...
Those are hierarchies too, but what he's talking about are the hierarchies of law. And that's what she's going to answer him with. She's, your laws don't impress me that much either. So we stopped with this line, wherever thou leadest his soul, I shall pursue. But death goes on contradicting her. Helmut, you would read?
But to her kind cause, he had insisting on the decree, insisting on the immutable law and the significance of creatures. Out of the rolling waste of might, there came born from the midnight and noble a voice, majesty, and appalling scorn. As when the storm-haired titan's throne throws on a swimmer its tremendous bark, remembering all the joy its waves have drawn. So from sovereign might against the woman's boundless heart arose the almighty cry of the universal death. As thou, godliness, or feet that tread my stars, frail creature with the courage that aspires, forgetting thy bounds before thy mortal role, their orbs were coiled before thy soul was formed. I, death, created them out of my world. All things I have built in them and I destroyed. I made the worlds my mortal. Each joy a mesh, a hunger, amorous, with suffering by life that devours. My image seemed mortal, whose spirit is my wandering death, whose transient was imagined by my smile, fleeting, clutching thy poor gains to thy trembling breast, pierced by my pangs, time shall not see the blind slave of my death force, whom I compel to sin, that I may punish, desire that I scourge thee with despair and grief, and thou come bleeding to me at the last, thy nothingness never last, my greatness no term, no attempt forbidden heavens, meant for the souls that can obey me. As in their somber shrines thy thread awake, from their uneasy iron hearted sleep, the furious, who revengeful fill desire, dread, blessed in skies, her passion hopes hope to live, the unknowns, lightning star, and terrified lone, sodden, hunted by the hounds of heaven. Wounded and forsaken soul thou feel through the long torture of the centuries. Nor many lives of force the tyrant's wrath, hell cannot slake, nor heaven's mercy has raged.
Thank you. This is the almighty cry of universal death. He's really very fierce. And he mocks her. He says, do you think you've got divine wings or feet that can tread my stars? You are so frail. You're a human being. Your life is limited. Your body is weak. You have this courage that aspires, but you can only aspire like that if you forget your limits, your bounds of thought, your mortal role, the fact that you are a being subject to death and ignorance. Their orbs, this refers to my stars, their orbs were coiled before thy soul was formed. They've been there for eons. I, death, created them out of my nothingness. All things I have built in them, among these stars. And I destroy. I made the worlds my net. A net to catch people and things. Each joy is a mesh of that net which keeps you tied, a hunger amorous of its suffering prey that enjoys devouring, life that devours. This is my image that you should be seeing in all things. You are immortal, you're subject to death and ignorance, and your spirit is my wandering breath, whose transience was imagined by my smile. I laughed when I created it. So now run away, please. Flee, clutching thy poor gains, whatever small things I have given you. Hold them to your trembling breast. You will be pierced by my pangs, my punishments, which time will not soon soothe them. They will last a long time. You are just a blind slave of my death force, and I compel you, human being, to sin so that I can punish you. I compel you to desire so that I can punish you with that, scourge you with despair and grief, and at the end you will come bleeding to me at the last, to death. Your nothingness recognized, my greatness known. Turn back. Don't attempt to continue into these forbidden happy fields, these happy fields of heaven, which are meant for the souls that can obey my law. If you don't, what will happen is that your tread, the tread of your feet, will disturb in their somber shrines. They will wake up from the uneasy, iron-hearted sleep, the furies, the vengeful spirits who punish fulfilled desire. These furies belong to Greek mythology, and that is their task, to avenge fulfilled desire. Dread, you should be fearful now, lest in skies where your passion for Satyavan, you hoped that you would live in those heavens, the unknown's lightning start. The vengeful gods will strike you down with bolts of lightning, and then you will have to run away, terrified, alone, sobbing, haunted by those hounds, those hunting dogs of heaven, a wounded and forsaken soul. You will have to flee, go on fleeing through the long torture of the centuries. And many lives will not exhaust the time, tireless wrath, which even suffering in hell cannot quench, nor can even heaven's mercy make it less. We do not have to believe this dark voice. We don't have to pay attention to his threats. And Savitri knows that very well.
In a way, how what he's describing, that is the normal life threat, putting sin on people. And it seems also here it's only working when you accept the law, how he's
So Savitri is not going to accept all this. She knows much better. But
But what the desire? He says unfulfilled desire will give you all these negative things. And if it's fulfilled, you'll be punished by gods.
Yeah.
That doesn't have any truth either.
God never punish anybody.
No, I mean higher powers, whatever fury comes up.
He's trying to terrify her, because he hasn't yet been able to recognize who she is, who she really is. But perhaps Sri Aurobindo is also sharing this with us, as Margaret said, because these are kind of common conceptions that are there in humanity, and he can remind them us of them. And Savitri is going to do just the opposite. That's constantly what she's doing throughout this book. Of book 10. Yes, Jerry.
Could we read it, this text, as an inner dialogue? Instead
within herself.
All these things that I'm trying to are constantly all of us have. We all of us have constantly the choice of following the truth of our soul or our fear of what we think is physically reality. We all know that the physical reality is not the ultimate reality. So it's a beautiful inner dialogue also that's clarifying a lot of the questions put here.
I think that's the point, is clarification.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's a beautiful way done, but with the realization that this thing is happening in all of us.
I remember when we first started to read this book 10 some years back in the other little place. One of the younger people attending, he said, "But that's what we all think." And that is why Sri Aurobindo has put it here and why he's answering it. There's a line even that says, "Death, you are speaking truth, but the truth that you are speaking is a destructive truth. And what I'm answering you with is a truth that saves, that uplifts and saves." But it's interesting to have this dialogue played out for us.
W-R-A-T-H,
wrath, anger, fury.
And the self contains many different worlds, no? So the physical is not the only world. So the individual, the cosmic, and the transcendent, no? Everything is in you.
So he makes all these threats to her, but then he says, "I will take from thee the black eternal grip. I'm giving you a chance, clasping in thy heart thy fate's exiguous doles, whatever small good things your fate allows you. Now you depart in peace. Go away. I won't do anything to you. If peace for man is just." But Savitri answers him. Again, he's mocking her. He says, "I'm letting you go. Do you really think that human beings deserve my mercy, my peace?"
Can the Furies be met onto Indian mythology?
I don't know about that. For me, they come from ancient Greek mythology. And there they are, the terrible, vengeful spirits. No? So, but Sri Aurobindo's drawing on the whole scale of human experience in these lines.
Shalom, the Greek mythology,
the
Fury is the Gorgon?
The Gorgon, she's not exactly. The Furies, they are kind of terrible birds who will come and with their beaks tear apart whoever's done anything, violated these laws. And it's a kind of eternal punishment. It goes on and on. So he generously says, "I'm going to take this black eternal grip away from you, and you can go back." But Savitri refuses. Larry, would you read?
"But Savitri answered, 'You think scorn with scorn, the mortal woman to the dreadful Lord. Who is this God imagined by thy night contemptuously creating worlds, disdain, who made for vanity brilliant stars? Not he who has reared his temple in my thoughts and made his sacred floor my human heart. My God is will and triumphs in his paths. My God is love and sweetly suffers all. To him I have offered hope for sacrifice and gave my longings as a sacrament. Who shall prohibit or hedge in his course? The wonderful, the charioteer, traveler of the million roads of life, his steps familiar with the lights of heaven, tread without pain the sword-paved courts of hell. There he descends to edge eternal joy. Love's golden wings have power to fan thy void. The eyes of love give starlight through death's night. The feet of love tread naked hardest worlds. He labors in the depths, exalts on the heights. He shall remake thy universe, O death. She spoke, and for a while no voice replied, while still they traveled through the trackless night, and still that gleam was like a pallid eye covering the darkness with its doubtful gaze. Then once more came a deep and perilous pause in that unreal journey through the blind night. Once more a thought, a word in the void arose, and death made answer to the human soul.
Let's pause there. Thank you. What kind of a God is this, she says. What kind of God are you imagining with your night, with your darkness? This God who's just creating contemptuously, without respect, with disgust, worlds which he doesn't care about at all, who's made our brilliant stars just for nothing, for vanity. That's not the God who has built his temple in my thoughts, the God who has made my human heart his sacred floor. My God is will and triumphs in his power. What he does is not useless and meaningless. My God is love and sweetly suffers all. Here the word suffers means allows, permits. He doesn't forbid anything. To him I have offered hope. That's my sacrifice, my offering. And I've given my longings as a sacrament, as a sacred offering to him. Who shall prohibit or hedge in his course? My God, the wonderful, the charioteer, the swift charioteer is an allusion to Lord Krishna, I believe. He's a traveler of the million roads of life. His steps are familiar with the lights of heaven, but they also tread without pain the sword-paved courts of hell, which Sri Aurobindo has described in an earlier canto. There he descends even into hell to edge, to give some sharpness, some cutting edge to eternal joy. Love's golden wings have power to fan thy void, your emptiness. The golden wings of love can fly wherever they want in your empty darkness. The eyes of love gaze star-like through death's night. The feet of love tread naked, hardest worlds. They're ready to suffer if necessary. He labors, he works hard in the depths, and exults, he delights on the heights. That God whom I worship, he shall remake your universe, O death, your imagined world. She spoke, and for a while no voice replied. While still they traveled through the trackless night, so they're still moving forward somehow. And still that gleam, that little light in the darkness, which is the sign of Savitri's presence. It's like a pallid eye, a little pale eye, and it's troubling the darkness with its doubtful gaze. But then death comes back with his answer. Then once more came a deep and perilous pause in that unreal journey through blind nothingness. Once more a thought, a word in the void arose, and death made answer to the human soul. My emptiness, my nothingness. I've brought them into existence out of nothing, and they'll just go back to nothing.
It's not the God's void which has everything, no?
In this case, I think his void is empty, yes. I think so. Would you like to read on, please, Bhuvana? What is thy hope?
What is thy hope? To all those thou as well. This is my body's sweetest lure of bliss. Assailed by pain, afraid by canvas form, to please for a few years thy faltering sense, with honey of physical longing and the heart's fire, and a vain oneness seeking to embrace the brilliant ardor of a fugitive hour. And thou, what art thou, soul, the glorious dream of brief emotion made and glittering thought, a thin dance of fireflies speeding through the night, a sparkling firmament in life's sunny mire. Wilt thou claim immortality, O heart, crying against the eternal witnesses that thou and he are endless powers and last? Death only love and the inconscient void. I only am eternal and endure. I am the shapeless, formidable vast. I am the emptiness that men call space. I am a timeless nothingness carrying all. I am the inevitable, the new and new. I, death, am he. There is no other God. All from my depths are born, they live by death. All to my depths return and are no more. I have made the world by my conscience. My force is nature that creates and slays the hearts that hold, the limbs that long to live. I have made man her instrument and slave. His body I made my banquet, his life my food. Man has no other help but only death. He comes to me at his end for rest and peace. I, death, am the one refuge of thy soul.
Thank you. Oh, what are you hoping for? What are you aspiring for? This is thy body's sweetest lure of bliss. That's the best thing you can think of. Although the body is attacked by pain, it's a frail, precarious form that doesn't last long. To please for a few years your faltering sense, your sense which also will soon cease to enjoy, but to please it for a few years with honey of physical longings and the hearts of fire and a vain oneness seeking to embrace the brilliant idol of a fugitive hour, a short-lived moment of delight. And thou, Savitri, what art thou, soul, thou glorious dream of brief emotions made and glittering thoughts? Oh, like a thin dance of fireflies speeding through the night. Have you sometimes seen that? Yeah? A sparkling ferment in life's sunlit mire, some kind of luminous gas floating above the marsh. Are you going to claim immortality, O heart, crying against the eternal witnesses? Are you claiming that you and he, you and Satyavan, are endless powers, that you will last forever? Death only lasts, and the inconscient void, the emptiness. This is his claim. I only am eternal and endure. I am the shapeless, formidable vast, that vast emptiness of the universe. If we imagine the soul lost and wandering in that emptiness, it's really something formidable. I am the emptiness that men call space. I am a timeless nothingness carrying all. I am the illimitable. There's no end to me. I am the mute, the silent, alone, the one. I, death, am he. There is no other. All phenomena, all beings, all existences are born from my depths of nothingness. They live by death. All to my depths of nothingness return, and then they don't exist anymore. I have made a world by my inconscient force, my force without any consciousness. My force is nature, that creates and slays the hearts that hope, the limbs, the bodies that long to live. I have made man the instrument and slave of nature. I have made his body my banquet of delicious food. His life is my food. Man has no other help but only death. He comes to me at his end for rest and peace. I, death, am the one refuge of thy soul. Alice, you like to read?
The God who brings can help not man. They are my imaginations and my moods, reflecting in him but illusion's power. That which thou seest as thy immortal self is a shadowy icon of my infinite. Is death indeed dreaming of eternity? I am the immobile in which all things move. I am the nude in a heap in which they cease. I have no body and no tongue to speak. I commune not with human eye and ear. Only thy thought gave a figure to my word. Because, O aspirant to divinity, thou callest me to wrestle with thy soul. I have assumed a face, a form, a voice. But if there were a being witnessing all, how should he walk thy passionate desire? Aloof he watches soul to move, indifferent to thy cry in nameless calm. His being is pure, unmoving, motionless, one. One endless watches the inconscient scene where all things perish as the foam tars. The one that lives forever. There is no such a man. Changing was born, and there was no savior. Claims from grief, life, a bride of joy. There none love in never fretful eyes of tears, nor time is there, nor the vain vasts of space. It wears no living space. It has no name, no gaze, no heart that throbs. It asks no second to aid its being, share its joys. It is delight immortally alone. If thou desirest immortality, be then alone, sufficient to thy soul. Live in life thyself. Forget the man thou lovest. My last friend, death shall be thee from life. Then shalt thou rise into the unmoved source.
Mm, thank you. Anything to ask? We're getting a bit tired of this death and his claims. Right?
It is super ego.
It all sounds very empty.
Empty, yeah. Yes. That's because we have heard, on the other hand, the Savitri's voice, the voice of truth, you know, which is much more convincing. So shall we just look at the... Yeah?
One endless watches the inconscient scene. So is he describing the inconscient?
Mm.
If he is speaking of it, there's 593.
Sorry, which line is it? Would you read it again?
Yeah. It is line
423.
I have made a world.
No.
423.
I don't have any numbers here. Oh. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Shall we leave it there for today?
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.